Welcome to the Western Magazine Hour, stories and articles about the American West, produced at the Recording Library of West Texas.
Hello, this is Michael, reading from the archives of True West Magazine. Here's an article from the November-December issue, 1958. Christmas, 1848. Camp Desolation, they called it, that snow-smothered camp high in the Garita Mountains, where the hardy men of Colonel Fremont's ill-fated fourth expedition spent. By Bernice Martin. It was Christmas Eve, and the despairing men of Fremont's party huddled together on the 12,000-foot mountaintop knew that it was unlikely they would ever see another. Too weak and miserable to talk, they dreamed continually of food and the Christmas dinners at home. Colonel John Charles Fremont, who accomplished this seemingly impossible more times than once in his former explorations, had ignored the warnings of old trappers and Indian guides to try to lead his men through one of the highest and most rugged of all the Rocky Mountain ranges. On this fourth expedition, disaster had overtaken the party. For a week, they had been pinned down at the wretched camp on a small rocky point at the edge of a bleak, windy peak in the La Garita Mountains. Again and again, small parties of men had attempted to find another camp, but the driving blizzards drove them back. Then Fremont's advance party, which had crossed the high, bare stone ridge to the headwaters of the Winemaker Creek, a few storm-battered miles beyond, returned. To cross the divide, they reported, was even more hopeless. On this day before Christmas, they managed to move their camp back about 2 miles to the edge of a large pine forest. It took incredible effort. The deep snow would bear them up for 2 or 3 steps with their heavy loads. Then at the next step, they would break through, going waist deep, and have to scramble out as best they could to try again. They took advantage of every steep descent, fixing their parfleches so they would slide and giving them a push, which would send them bounding and sliding along 50 or 100 yards at a stretch. Sometimes they fetched up with great violence against a tree or rock, and occasionally a man would have his feet knocked out from under him. But camp was finally set up by the headsprings of a little stream which they believed led them down to the Rio Grande del Norte in the San Luis Valley below. The snow continued day and night, and the high wind off the mountaintops filled the air with drifting snow at all times. At frequent intervals, they could hear the roar of snow slides which rustled from the deep sides of the mountains and crashed like big guns into the canyons below. Camp Desolation, the men named the camp, although Fremont, in his report much later, called it the Christmas Camp. The men dug holes in the deep snow and built their campfires in the center. There were several such fires, and each little mess was separate, since the pits were so deep the men could not look over the sides into the next pit. Down in these holes, they slept, spreading what remained of their blankets on the snow. For days they had been tearing strips from the blankets to make crude moccasins and leggings for their frostbitten feet, and the blankets were shrinking fast in size. There was no other timber but the pine at the Christmas camp, and the strong pine smoke, confined in the deep pits, together with the reflection from the snow, had partially blinded all the men. They could not have seen the sights of their guns, even if there had been game. But there was none. No vestige of life appeared in the lofty solitude. The men would have welcomed the hoarse cry of a raven or the howling of a wolf to break the awful silence of the dismal white world. The mules that were left stood huddled together on the mountain. They had given up in vain for search of grass. The long beards about their mouths stood like icicles, and their breath settled on their breasts, coating their front and sides with thick white hoar frosts. The snow clung to their hooves and fetlocks until it formed a ball half a foot thick, and they walked continually on snowy stilts. Their ears had frozen perfectly stiff, and some had broken pieces off to leave bleeding stumps. They had devoured each other's tails, and in some cases, even parts of the rump or shoulders. At night, they tried to eat the blankets off the dozing men, and the men were wary lest they find human flesh the next resort. The unfortunate animals roamed all night, pawing in the snow now and then. Occasionally, one would tumble down into the fires in the pits, ineffectually hunting food in the cooking pots to relieve their ravenous hunger. The men looked even worse than the mules. For 2 months, their beards and hair had grown. Their breath froze upon their faces, making their lips so stiff from the ice, it was difficult to speak. Their eyes were almost shut from the ice, which froze on their lashes, and the snow blindness. Long icicles hung down from their nostrils. Each hair of their beards stood out to itself alone, white and stiff with frost. There were sores on their faces from freezing and burn, and short rations for weeks had whittled the flesh away to blackened masks. By Christmas Eve, they were reduced to the meat of the frozen mules for their entire diet. Later, one of the survivors, named Breckenridge, wrote up the menu for Christmas Dinner 1848 in a jocular vein. Menu, Camp Desolation, December 25th, 1848. Soup, mule tail. Fish, baked white mule, boiled gray mule. Meat, mule steak, mule chops, stewed mule, fried mule, broiled mule, boiled mule. Scrambled mule, poached mule, French fried mule, minced mule, damned mule. Mule on toast, without toast. Short ribs of mule with applesauce. Relishes, black mule, brown mule, bay mule, roan mule, yellow mule, tallow candles. Beverages, snow water, water. Old Bill Williams, experienced mountain man though he was, had arrived in camp with the returning advance party the night before Christmas in such a state of exhaustion that he sat in a stupor until his companions helped him to one of the pit fires. But he was apparently somewhat revived the next day, for Fremont chose him with three other men to make a desperate attempt to get help from the Mexican settlements miles to the south. Colonel John Charles Fremont was a little man, only an inch or so over 5 feet, and he had frozen one of his legs, which made difficulty in walking, but he stood tall as always, and no one ever questioned his orders. King, Creutzfeldt, Breckinridge, and Bill Williams were to proceed with all possible speed down the Rio del Norte to Abiquiu, where they were to procure provisions and mules to relieve the rest of the party. The distance, as far as he could make out, was about 180 miles, and he would expect them back in 16 days. Why King was chosen to lead the party remains a mystery. A week later, he was to lie down beside the trail and die of starvation and exhaustion. Creutzfeldt was the botanist of the expedition. Breckinridge, who outlived all the survivors, stated long afterward that he and Fremont had been in many tight places together, and he was chosen to go because the colonel knew that he was the hardest and toughest man in the party. Tall, ungainly Bill Williams, with his shock of graying red hair, took pride in his reputation as a mountain man. He was always a grotesque sight when riding a mule at the head of whatever party he happened to be guiding. He had a habit of lopping forward until he gave the appearance of a hunchback, his stirrups ridiculously short, making his buckskin-clad knees keep company with the saddle horn. But this time, there were no mules. The last mules had finally perished after being driven to a nearby hilltop, which seemed to have patches of grass on it. Only the grass turned out to be tops of bare trees, buried in the deep snow, and the mules never moved from the spot. On Christmas Day, the rescue party started. They carried as little weight as possible with them. They took one blanket apiece, a few pounds of frozen mule meat, about a pound of sugar, a little macaroni, and a few candles. All the food in camp except the frozen mules. They had 3 Hawken rifles for defense against the Indians, about 50 bullets, 1 shotgun, and 1 pound of powder. Breckinridge handed a sack of $1,200 in Spanish doubloons to Fremont, asking that he take charge of it and bring it out with him when he came. The Rio Grande was only 8 miles away, but it took them 3 difficult days to reach it. Their food was gone now, there was no game in sight, and they began living on the parched leather of their boots, belts, and knife scabbards. At Williams's suggestion, they attempted to take a shortcut across the big oxbow bend of the Rio Grande, which was considerably shorter, but much harder traveling. He had overestimated their strength, and now they were in plenty of trouble. In a few days, they were starving, snowblind, half mad from the terrible agony that they were enduring. Back at the mountaintop camp, Fremont and his men began on Christmas Day the construction of a rough sled about 6 feet long on which they hoped to carry their baggage to the river. They continued to eat the mule meat while it was within reach, for they knew that they could carry little with them. The way to the river was rough. Passing over the precipitous mountain spurs and deep ravines in which the water was pitching and brawing beneath the ice as they crossed, they clambered downward, breaking through the deep snow's crust every few steps. They packed the baggage on their backs. The sled did not work and was abandoned from the start. They soon found about a mile a day was the best that they could do, and the cold was so unbearable that they frequently had to take refuge under the shelter of rocks, making a fire to keep from freezing. They reached the river with high hopes of finding game, but the deer and elk had been driven out by the deep snow. Anxiously, they settled down to wait for the relief party, trying to subsist on boiled shoestrings, roasted parfleches, and such leather as remained. New Year's came and went, anything but a happy day. They waited 2 weeks, but the rescuing party did not arrive. 2 days later, Fremont, with a man named Godey, a strong young Negro called Sanders, and a 14-year-old boy who seemed to be standing up amazingly well, started walking on the ice down the middle of the river on a second rescue mission. The others were ordered to follow as they could. This party was moving as fast as they were able, came upon 2 Indians with some horses several days later, and Fremont engaged them to pilot their group to the nearest settlement. A day or so later, they came upon the first rescue party. King had already died, and the other 3 were deranged and sightless, nearly dead. Fremont had them hoisted onto the Indian horses and carried in to the little Mexican settlement at the present site of Conejos, Colorado. It was Godey who collected all the provisions available, hired every Mexican he could with their mules, and hurried back up the river. Traveling day and night, he brought food to the survivors, scattered for many miles along the river. 11 men had died altogether, and the wolves and ravens, plentiful now, quarreled over their remains. The worst off of the men were lifted onto the Mexican horses, but most of the unfortunate men still had to walk. At last, their tortured feet would carry them no farther, and for the last 20 miles, they crawled on their hands and knees. At the settlement, plenty threatened to be as hurtful to them as what had the day before. They ate at all hours of the day and through the night, and were violently ill as a consequence, but no more died. Colonel Fremont had gone on to Taos, to Kit Carson's house, where the famous scout immediately sent a rescue party to bring all survivors in where they could be adequately cared for. Their terrible ordeal was over. It had been a well-equipped party when they started out. 34 men, including geologists, botanists, artists, and photographers, over 100 mules with fine saddles and pack saddles, generous equipment and supplies costing more than $10,000, even a small 3-pounder brass cannon. All was lost. Over 100 years later, forest rangers in the area found the Christmas camp. Sled runners, almost rotted away, lie untouched at the edge of the pine forest. Several campfires were uncovered where they lay under the pine needles. There are stumps 4.5 to 10 feet high, scattered over an area several hundred feet square, which indicate the great depth of the snow when they were cut. The little brass cannon, which must be somewhere in the vicinity, has never been found, nor have the Spanish doubloons given into Fremont's care on that desolate Christmas day, and undoubtedly buried somewhere along the trail. True West Magazine, edition from December 1982. The year Santa came in a wagon. A Christmas surprise in Oklahoma. Story by Grace Haynes Jones. Our family arrived at the homestead early in the spring of 1902. For the first few weeks, the four of us lived in a small tent out on the open prairie. It had no floor except the buffalo grass, and the entrance was merely a canvas flap, not even securely fastened. We chose a spot in a shallow ravine, a draw, it was called. We hoped to have some protection from the wind, but soon learned that a draw is fitly named. It is like a chimney that draws the wind. We were among the first settlers in that area and could not see another house or building from our home. There was not even a tree in sight, just buffalo grass everywhere on the rolling prairie. For years, my father, the Reverend Grant L. Hayes, had served as pastor of Methodist churches in southern Kansas. He began his work as a minister in 1891 under the leadership of William J. Martindale, presiding elder of the Wichita district. In 1901, we were living in Hazleton, a small town in Barber County, Kansas. That fall, my father drove out to Coldwater in the Dodge City district to assist the pastor in leading the singing at a revival meeting. When superintendent of the Dodge City District offered my father work as a missionary in Beaver County, Oklahoma Territory, my father eagerly accepted. He had filed on a homestead a few months before, 160 acres of land, almost in the middle of what later became a big circuit. Years before, the Oklahoma Panhandle was put into the Dodge City District. It so remained for many years, and was still a mission field in 1902. After we arrived at the homestead, my parents and we two children were busy getting settled. By early fall, we felt well prepared for winter, living in a snug one-room dugout on one side of the ravine. Ivanhoe, our county store and post office, was 7 miles away. We usually got the mail once a week. If there was enough money, we could buy a few groceries. One day in early fall, my father drove to Ivanhoe alone. I always watched for his return. When the team and buggy came over the rise, I rushed to meet him. Even before I climbed up beside him, I knew something good had happened. "What is it, Papa?" I asked. "Did you buy me something? Some candy, maybe? No, chicken, he often called my brother or me by that pet name. There wasn't enough money, but you just wait. I'll tell you all about it when we get to the house. His voice was so cheerful, I knew it must be something special. I could hardly wait until we got home. This time, he did not stop to unhitch the team. Just tie them to a post, he told my brother Virgil. Then come on inside. Just listen to this, he said as he seated himself, then looked around at us and began to read a letter he had taken from his coat pocket. The letter was from Yonkers, a suburb of New York City. It told us that members of the Home Missionary Society of a Methodist church there were planning to fill a barrel to be sent to us. They wanted a description of our family and measurements of each member. They also wanted to know our clothing needs. After discussing the subject, my mother got out the tape measure. Virgil was growing so fast that she wondered how much she should add to the measurements for him. I had not begun to sprout up so much. My father promptly answered that letter and mailed it the next time we went to Ivanhoe. After that, there was nothing we could do but wait. In later years, my mother told how she secretly hoped the missionary barrel would arrive before Christmas, since my parents would not be able to buy any gifts that year. The missionary voucher that came every 3 months did not go far in supplying our needs. Life on the homestead that first year was not easy. I was only 8 and too young to realize the hardships. Virgil was 13 in the fall, but he did not talk much, and we seldom knew what he was thinking. How difficult it was for my mother to prepare 3 meals each day, especially when we still lived in a tent. Living out of doors, as we did, merely increased our appetites. We often heard my mother singing or humming a tune. This might be to dispel the blues, or, as she would tell us, to express her thankfulness. She secretly looked forward to the time when we would have a real house, one built of sod, like most of the old settlers had. We started work on our dugout the first day we arrived on the claim, but the digging went slowly. Many times my father was called away. That summer, hordes of people came in to settle homesteads. My father organized a circuit with several preaching stops. My father usually took his auto harp with him, even on weekdays. People were eager to hear him sing, accompanied by this instrument. When my mother went along, they often sang duets. One of my tasks was to herd our 3 cows and not let them wander away. For a time, we had no fenced pasture, and we did not want our cows mixing with the range cattle. We wore out 2 umbrellas, scaring those range cattle, before we got a dog to chase them away from our home. Another job of mine was to fill the coal hod with cow chips. It was the only fuel we had for our little Topsy stove. It cooked our food and kept us warm in winter. At first, we could find plenty of chips on the prairie. During the summer, we sometimes took a big wagon and gathered loads of them for winter. By late fall, we had a huge pile of cow chips near the dugout. Virgil built an igloo with them. One night, when we still lived in the tent, a downpour sent a stream rushing down our ravine. When my mother and father lit the lamp, my mother exclaimed, "Grant, pick up the children quick before they drown." Virgil and I slept on the ground, which sloped slightly. We were only inches from the flood that came surging past. My parents pulled 2 trunks close to our big bed. We all slept crossways the rest of the night with our feet resting on the 2 trunks. One afternoon, the tent blew down in a sudden gust of wind. I was the only one inside at the time, but I was more scared than hurt. One night, we were all asleep when a windstorm suddenly snatched the tent away, leaving us no protection. The dugout was almost finished, so we moved into it right away and were thankful for its comforting shelter. The older settlers, who had been there for a number of years, lived quite well but did not have much cash. My father's salary consisted mostly of produce or anything they could supply. Few of the new settlers were much better off than we. Since it was still open range and we had not been able to do any fencing, we planted no crops that first year, nor did we make any attempt to raise a garden. Our cows were a valuable asset, providing much of our food. A widow, Auntie Cox, as everyone called her, owned a sheep ranch close to the Texas line. She was generous, and we never forgot her many kindnesses. One time, she gave us a sack of wheat shorts for cow feed. It was clean, and my mother used it to make gems, muffins. For a whole week, we ate gems in place of bread. Virgil and I thought they were delicious, spread with butter and syrup. Syrup was made of white sugar, as we happened to have plenty on hand. There was cottage cheese for dinner and supper, and plenty of milk from our Jersey cows. However, after a week on such fare, our mother said she never wanted to see another gem. When we later laughingly told of our situation, church members asked why we didn't tell them. They said they had no idea we were short of food. But we were not starving, and my parents were loath to ask for help. In spite of hardships, we enjoyed life and were really a happy family. How contented we were that fall when we were snugly settled for the winter. Once in a while, one of us would mention the missionary barrel. One day in November, my father said, "I keep thinking we'll get a letter from Yonkers. We're so far from the railroad, they should let us know in plenty of time." Our nearest railway station was at Englewood, 35 miles to the north, just over the line in Kansas. Thanksgiving Day came and went. Still, there was no word. "We'll surely hear about it soon now," my mother assured us. "It takes a lot of work and time to fill a barrel and to select all the clothing and everything." Then it was mid-December. Each day we became more concerned. Would it never come? At last, it was the 24th of the month, and all hope of having the barrel for Christmas was gone. I was not so concerned. How could I know there were to be no gifts, as usual, for Christmas? Our parents had always taken care of such things. All that fall and up into early winter, the forecast had been lovely. Not even a hard frost at night. As the day was drawing to a close, the sun, a great red ball, slowly sank toward the horizon, casting shadows on the wild prairie. When I came near the dugout from playing, I heard my mother moving about inside, getting supper. She was humming a tune. To hear her, no one would have guessed at her heartache, knowing she had no gifts for her children on this Christmas Eve. It was hard for her to face this deprivation. In later years, she would tell me about it. However, she did not want to let on how she felt. She was a truly genuine Christian and lived her religion every day. Her strong spirit kept her going when fainter hearts would have given up in despair. Some of the new settlers did just that. A lot of them moved back to Kansas or Missouri. My mother emerged from the dugout. She stood there a few moments, her tiny figure framed in the open doorway. Her face was a rosy pink, flushed from working over a hot stove in close quarters. "My, how still it is," she remarked. "It's so warm, too. You'd never think it was Christmas Eve." Then she turned back to her duties inside. The evening chores were all done. The cows and horses quietly rested in the fenced enclosure. The chickens were slowly finding their way to the crude shelter where they roosted. Virgil's slender figure was almost hidden in the shadow as he leaned back against the stack of feed. My father stood like a towering colossus on the rim of the draw, silhouetted against the flowing sky where the sun had beamed only a few seconds before. I skipped rope from the dugout toward the corral, then stopped to get my breath. Scarcely a sound could be heard as we paused those few minutes before the shades of night began to deepen. Suddenly, in the stillness, we heard a far-off sound, the rattle of a wagon somewhere beyond the horizon. "Papa, do you suppose it's coming here?" I jumped up and down in excitement. We rarely had visitors, and since we were among the earliest of the new settlers, we seldom heard the faintest sound of anyone passing by. The Tuttle Trail, which went across the west side of our claim, was just over the low hill out of sight from the dugout. It led from the old cow town, Dodge City, Kansas, 90 miles due south of our place, to where some pioneer towns were located in the Texas Panhandle. The Texas line was only 7 miles to the south of our place. It was one of the few roads in that part of the country. I kept up an excited chatter until my father said, "Hush, listen. Seems to be coming closer. Can't tell for sure, though. Maybe they are coming home from Inglewood." It seemed an eternity that we waited, but as the sound grew louder, we knew it had left the trail. It was cutting toward our house. I ran to the dugout. "Mama, there's somebody coming. Hurry up. Come out here, quick." Our eyes were all turned in the direction of the noise. Then we saw the horses' heads appearing on the horizon, and a man sitting in a lumber wagon. He was driving straight toward us across our land. As he guided his team into the yard, we saw that he was a stranger. He stopped in front of the dugout, and my father walked toward him. "Reverend Hayes, I believe," he said, to which my father assented. "My name is Bogle. I went up to Inglewood yesterday, just getting back. Thought I'd best fetch these here things right over, being it's nigh Christmas. Figured you'd want 'em tonight." "Yes," was about all my father could say. We were all speechless with surprise. For an instant, we just stood there. When I looked up at my mother, I knew she was overcome with joy. Anyone would have thought by the look on her face that the heavens had opened and dropped a treasure in her lap. Bogle told of going to the depot at Inglewood for some freight. The agent asked if he knew us or if we lived near him. When Bogle replied that his claim was only 2 or 3 miles from our place, the depot agent asked if he could deliver some things that had arrived that very day. "Well, well, well," my father exclaimed. I don't remember what else he said, but I do know that he and my mother tried to express their appreciation to this stranger who, even more than he realized, was bearing precious gifts on Christmas Eve. In the back of the wagon was a wooden barrel, a big, fat one. It was about the biggest, fattest barrel I had ever seen. But that was not all. Sitting beside it was a good-sized wooden box. While the men were unloading and carrying these two items into the dugout, my father told about the missionary barrel we had been expecting. "Every time we went after the mail," he said, "we hoped to receive a letter telling us the barrel had been shipped. When we got no word, our hopes waned and finally died. But now, you have fulfilled our expectations. I only wish I could pay you for your trouble, but 15 cents is all I have at the present." Of course, Bogle would not have accepted pay. During the conversation, he mentioned that his wife and children had gone to spend Christmas with her folks in Kansas. "Well now," my father said, "no one should be alone on Christmas Day. We have been invited to the Van Giesens for Christmas dinner. I'm sure you would be most welcome in their home. Please do come along. They live over near Kiowa Creek." "Yes, I know where they live, and I've met Mr. Van Giesen, but I hate to do that," Bogle demurred. However, at my father's insistence, he agreed to meet us at the Van Giesen home the next day. By that time, supper was ready, and though my mother urged him to eat with us, he declined, saying he needed to get home to look after things. After a hurried meal, my mother and I quickly did up the dishes while the menfolk opened the barrel and box. Soon, we were ready to begin. My father lifted things out and handed them to my mother. She held up each article, and we decided who it was for. Exclamations of surprise and pleasure burst from our lips as each thing appeared. We did not hurry, and everything was enjoyed to the utmost. There was clothing of all kinds, long underwear for each one of us, soft, fleecy, and warm. There were dresses for my mother and me, and outer clothing for the others. My father received a new suit of the finest black wool material. I can't begin to describe everything packed in that barrel and box. My family talked about it in later years, and whenever we spoke of the missionary barrel, we thought of this one. There had been others before, and more came later, but none of them could compare with the one from Yonkers, New York. Thus, the evening passed, and it was growing late. The box was empty, and little was left in the barrel. My father reached into the barrel and brought out something with the garment wrapped around it. When my mother unrolled it, I saw an oblong pasteboard box about the size of a shoebox. She read aloud, "For Grace," and handed it to me. With trembling fingers, I untied the string and lifted the lid. What I saw would delight the heart of any little girl. Inside was a doll, the most beautiful doll I had ever seen. When I carefully picked her up, her blue eyes opened, and she seemed to be smiling at me. Anyone might wonder how, after all these years, I can so accurately describe that little doll and her wardrobe. The truth is, I still have the doll and most of her clothes. I named her Rosebud, and she became my favorite doll. Rosebud is one of my most prized possessions. Now, as I look back to that time so long ago, I remember it as one of the happiest Christmases of my life. Most assuredly, the best Christmas of all, when we opened the missionary barrel. True West Magazine, December 2021 edition. Ho, ho, ho. Sweet treats were greatly anticipated and appreciated at Christmas time on the American frontier. By Sherry Monahan. Allie Earp recalled how much her husband, Virgil, loved candy at Christmas time. She recalled, "We'd had a right good Christmas dinner. We still had some nuts left over and some of the peppermint candy Virg liked." She recalled that fond memory from when they lived in Tombstone, Arizona Territory in the early 1880s. It's hard to imagine Virgil Earp, Annie Oakley, or Jesse James sitting down to a plate of peppermint candy during the Christmas season. But many a pioneer did. Nebraska resident Ella Oblinger penned a letter to her grandparents in 1880, and she wrote, "I must tell you how I spent Christmas Eve and how we all went to see a Christmas tree on Christmas Eve. I got a new red oil calico dress. I will send you a piece of them. And each one of us girls got a doll. And Uncle Giles put a book on for Sabra and me, and each one of us girls a string with candy and raisins on it." St. Louis, Missouri native Eleanor Dale Runcie went to live with her Aunt Ellie and Cousin Eleanor in San Francisco and remembered the 1900 Christmas fondly. She wrote home to her mother, "My darling mother, but now for our Christmas. Monday morning, I ran to the grocer's for cranberries and popcorn, which I proceeded to pop, string, etc., and was busily occupied all morning, Eleanor being gone to deliver presents and other matters. After lunch, I got all the trimmings together and began my very enjoyable task of decking the little tree, while Cousin Eleanor rested up in my room on the reclining chair in her warm crimson dressing gown and strung popcorn and berries with lightning rapidity. I gave Miss M a heart-shaped fancy box of candy. Candy, nuts, popcorn, and fruits were sold by mercantile stores, bakeries, confectionery shops, and other locales. A store called the John Jeffries and Company in Ottawa, Kansas, advertised that it had fine mixed Christmas candy at 10 cents per pound. It even offered discounts to Christmas tree committees, teachers, and others who wanted 20 pounds or more. It also sold fancy paper sacks to hold the candy, nuts, oranges, lemons, popcorn, or other treats. The Candy Kitchen in El Dorado, Kansas, advertised itself as the place where old Santa Claus suggests at which to buy pure Christmas candies. They offered creams, chocolates, caramel, peanut and coconut bars, taffies, butterscotch, whorehound, peppermint drops, nuts, and sugar-coated popcorn. The Dragon Drugstore in Los Angeles, California, offered all kinds from old-fashioned taffies to the finest French chocolates. In 1899, the French Drug Company in Tacoma, Washington, offered a fine assortment of tasty holiday treats, including glazed fruits, assorted creams and chocolates, bonbons, chocolate almonds, peppermint chocolate, Italian walnut cream bars, handmade wafers, and a variety of nut brittles. Candy canes, considered a real treat, were often given to children by Santa Claus and were hung on Christmas trees. They were sometimes given as prizes in contests, like the popcorn string one in Salt Lake City, Utah. A couple threw an informal party and challenged attendees to make popcorn strings to decorate the tree. The person with the longest string won a candy cane. In 1882, the mining town of Chloride, New Mexico, had a Christmas ball at the Monte Cristo. The building was decorated with evergreens and Merry Christmas signs. 25 ladies attended, and they sold lottery tickets for 25 cents. Mr. Jim Blaine held ticket number 17, which entitled him to a candy cane and lesser prizes, including sacks of flour. True West Magazine, November 2017. A Bozeman Christmas. Clashes over booze and a founder's murder get swept under the rug 150 years ago to prove this Montana Territory town was keeping with the Christmas spirit. By Megan Saar. On Christmas Day in 1867, 3 years after the founding of this fair Montana Territory city, Bozeman was elected by citizens as the county seat. This was a joyous occasion for a town that had experienced a tumultuous year. The frontiersmen who helped blaze the Bozeman Trail through Wyoming Territory into the gold fields of Montana Territory, where he founded this town named after him, had been killed on April 20th. His murder remains a mystery to this day. Thomas Cover, who was traveling with Bozeman to negotiate flour contracts with U.S. Army posts, claimed Blackfeet had attacked and killed the frontiersmen. But historians have speculated that Bozeman was killed by Cover or by Bozeman's richest man, cattle rancher Nelson Story. On that Christmas day, nobody knew if Bozeman's murderer was standing among them. To protect settlers living in Bozeman and the Gallatin Valley, the War Department established Fort Ellis on August 27th. That Christmas, soldiers patrolled the fort surrounded by a wood stockade that within a year would be removed. The War Department decided wood stockades gave a bad impression that U.S. soldiers were cowards who hid from their enemies. soldiers and settlers were already clashing by Christmas. The fort's first commander, Robert S. Lamont, had declared war on saloon keepers. On December 11th, soldiers tore down a log cabin near Bozeman where troops had purchased liquor. 3 days later, they were sent into town to destroy liquor at two businesses. Bozeman was flush with booze in 1867, having just gotten its first brewery, established by German immigrants Jacob Speith and Charles Krug. Christmas prayers could be lifted to heaven in Bozeman's first frame structure, the Methodist Episcopal Church, completed that year. Christmas Day liturgy was held in the same place where litigants sought to prove their innocence. The church caretaker made a point of throwing dirt and sawdust on the wood floors to protect it from the tobacco juice spit out by folks when the building served as the territorial Supreme Court. Locals could get supplies and goods for their Christmas celebrations from the mercantile store owned by Tuller and Rich Wilson, with a new partner who had arrived that year, their brother, Lester. Montana State University archivist Kim Allen Scott has said the 1866 photo of the mercantile alongside the Empire Corral, owned by brother Davis Wilson, may be the oldest known photograph of Bozeman. Davis was also the town's first school teacher and the reverend. He sought to prove to the world that Bozeman did indeed have a pleasant Christmas 150 years ago when he sent this account of the community's Christmas reverie to the Virginia City newspaper, the Montana Post, on January 4, 1868. A Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year to you and to all Montana, to the miner, the packer, the hunter, the merchant, the mechanic, and all. Aye, what a world of thought and a feeling of hopes and joys rest in those few little words. How often they have been repeated by dear and distant friends, and how, even now, through the dark, backward, and abysm of time, their echo falls upon the enchanted ear like the rarest and richest music. I sit by a blazing fireplace and listen to its murmuring song of comfort, and I see images in the fiery coals that add a sort of melancholy to the time. I look out from my window, and the snow is falling, falling fast. From the misty atmosphere comes the memories of the new year and the Christmas times past. And what a change! But these little words are still whispering their sweet illusions, and neither time nor circumstance nor a suffering soul within could banish them from our hearts. A low howl comes out from the mountains, and the dark storm clouds are hovering lower. God pity the helpless and the unclad. May we not forget in our rejoicing, when we repeat the old-time greetings, there is another meaning in them that is half in prayer and half in doubt, when uttered for the poor and the unfortunate. But with these sober remarks by way of introduction, and in the effort of keeping my communication balanced, should I carry our rejoicings too far, let me here make it known to all of the world, for no doubt all the world is interested, that we of Bozeman have not been behind them in observing the holidays. On this eventful Christmas Eve, all the Masons and all those who love Masons met at the large and spacious hall, 26 by 60, newly built in this place, for the purpose of having grand entertainment in the way of dancing. Our company was honored by many friends from the West Gallatin, by our excellent captain's lady from Fort Ellis, and by the fort's many gentlemanly officers, besides many of our fair and brilliant faces who inhabit the homely dwellings of stirring, enterprising Bozeman. Who in the East shall henceforth say there is no society, no civilization here? To us, no rooms were ever decorated more gorgeously. Chandeliers never shone more brilliantly. Hearts never beat more joyfully. Music never thrilled more sweetly. Refreshments never refreshed more refreshingly. Social spirits never associated more socially. The many twinkling feet never twinkled to proportionate time or to dulcet airs more airily. Our friend Frazier is about to repeat the entertainment on New Year's Eve, when we are expected to glide from the old year to the new in the right time. Bozeman's Boosters had won the day that Christmas. It is still the county seat of Montana's third most populous county, Gallatin County. And the Masonic Lodge No. 6, where that Christmas celebration was held, remains active to this day. Interestingly, our friend Frazier, who provided the Christmas entertainment, was none other than George Frazier. The Georgia native and his wife, Elmira, owned the City Hotel and were the last to say goodbye to their lodger, Bozeman, before he left for his fateful journey with cover. By 1874, Bozeman's citizens were celebrating Christmas like many would back east, reports David Walter, author of Christmastime in Montana. He shares an account demonstrating such, published in Bozeman Times on December 29, 1874. One need not be very aged to remember his Presbyterian grandfather's holy horror when the Episcopal Church bells rang out Christmas, nor the time when Christmas trees were nothing less than popish abominations. A Gothic window or a cross upon a steeple was enough to turn any deacon's stomach in those days, and all the women in the congregation had the cramps at the mention of a Christmas tree. But those times have passed away, and Christmas has become a thing of joy to all in the land. In accordance with local custom, the Sunday school had its tree on Christmas Eve, and long before the hour, the church was filled to overflowing. The tree was a very fine one, and was loaded down with gifts. After a musical service by the school, the gifts were distributed under the paternal supervision of Mr. Hoare as Santa Claus, who was the exact counterpart of the old man we once imagined popped down the chimneys of our youth. Everything passed off pleasantly, and great praise is due the ladies who had the arrangements in charge and who exerted themselves to the utmost to give success to the undertaking. The last legislature prohibited the firing of guns or pistols within the town limits or near any public gatherings. We commend the law to the attention of those who have been celebrating Christmas in Bozeman by the banging of firearms. Okay, perhaps Bozeman was still a bit uncivilized in how locals celebrated Christmas. Spreading Christmas cheer, though, through gunplay would have been an unusual scene in the civilized East. Merry Christmas. True West Magazine, December 2021. Christmas in the Pines by Marshall Trimble. The first recorded Christmas in northern Arizona, north of the Gila River, took place in 1853 at the foot of the snowy San Francisco peaks where the city of Flagstaff is today, and it was a wild and woolly affair. The celebrants were members of the Army Corps of Topographical Engineers, their military escorts, and helpers who were at the time mapping a future transcortical highway and railroad to California. The region had only recently become a part of the United States, and the topographical engineers were the frontier's rendition of America's astronauts in the second half of the 20th century. Secretary of War Jefferson Davis called upon them to survey and map it. The scout for the survey was the legendary Antoine Leroux, a veteran of some 30 years in the mountains with plenty of experience finding and making trails. The officer in charge of the little expedition was a young man named Lieutenant Emil W. Whipple. Earlier, Whipple had equipped and provisioned his men at Albuquerque before heading west along the 35th parallel. By December 23rd, they had reached the San Francisco peaks, where they were greeted by a raging snowstorm that brought them to an abrupt halt. Since the next day was Christmas Eve, Whipple decided it would be a good place to hole up for a couple of days and let the bone-weary men and animals rest. While unpacking the mules, Lieutenant John James, head of the military escort, discovered a hefty supply of rum and wine that had been cached by the men who had wanted to gladden their hearts on those cold winter nights. He also fished out a carton of fresh eggs that had been stowed in the grain sacks so they could survive the rigorous journey. This expected surprise inspired the enterprising lieutenant to concoct a special Christmas eggnog. So while the cooks were busy preparing a Christmas banquet, Jones was busy mixing bottles of liquid refreshment in a huge kettle hung over hot coals. Next, he stirred in the eggs and added a few items from his own secret recipe. That evening, all hands were invited to dip their tin cups into the kettle and enjoy the Christmas cheer. The next few hours were spent around the campfire. "We sat in a circle," Baldwin Mulhausen, the noted German artist and naturalist who chronicled the expedition, wrote. "Smoked, drank toasts, and told jokes. Hearts became lighter, blood ran more swiftly in the veins, and all joined in a hearty song fest that echoed through ravines and mountains that must have sadly interfered with a night's rest of sleeping wild turkeys." The celebration was, appropriately enough, multicultural. The joyous Mexicans sang their native corridos, complete with whoops, howls, and they even performed a moving pastoral. A couple of them had been captives of the Navajo, and they performed dances learned during their years of captivity. Some of the soldiers warbled beloved traditional Christmas carols, while the soldiers from the South sang Negro spirituals learned in their youth. Earlier, Whipple had dispensed some of the surplus gunpowder to the Mexican sheepherders, who proceeded to use it in celebration. At first, they fired pistols and rifles into the air, but soon graduated to salvos. The resounding shock waves knocked clumps of snow from the pine branches. The fireworks reached a sparkling climax with an impromptu pyrotechnics when one of the sheepherders threw a firebrand into a dry pine tree. The dead needles, rich in resin, sent flames and sparks high above the trees. The fearless Leroux sat quietly, taking in the revelry. He looked off into the piney woods and opined what a splendid opportunity it would be for the Indians to surprise us tonight. Fortunately, there were no war parties on the prod that night. After all the gunpowder and Christmas cheer was gone, the hearty celebrants crawled into their bedrolls and called it a night. According to Mulhausen, Christmas Day was spent in perfect quiet. It was another way of saying all hands were pretty hungover. But they hadn't forgotten the true meaning of Christmas, for he added poetically, "We looked up at the sublime summits of the San Francisco Mountains, and needed no temple made with hands wherein to worship our Creator."
Thank you for joining us for the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Your narrator has been Jack. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.